Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, true history. Later on, a story from the life of John Adams on the Cavalcade of America. But right now, it's the Radio Reader's Digest with Raymond Massey portraying Abe Lincoln and the Council of Sides. This episode first heard on CBS on February 13th, 1947.
Hallmark greeting cards bring you the true but little-known story of a young man who risked political defeat in order to help a friend. His name was Abraham Lincoln, and our star is Raymond Massey. For more than a third of a century, quality has been a habit with the makers of Hallmark cards. They have the pride of craftsmen in their name, H-A-L-L-M-A-R-K, Hallmark. That's why Hallmark cards are the kind of cards you can be proud to send, proud to receive. So when you want to send the very finest, look on the back for those three identifying words, a Hallmark card. Those three words, a Hallmark card, are your assurance of finest quality. They tell your friends you cared enough to send the very best. To be doubly sure, always look in the back of the card you choose for those three identifying words, a Hallmark card. Now to preside over our program this evening, here's our regular master of ceremonies, the young Broadway actor and producer, Richard Garmer.
Thank you, Tom Shirley, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You've heard many stories of Abraham Lincoln, his simplicity, his humor, his greatness. But our story tonight is one of the least known and most moving of Lincoln's whole career. An incident when Lincoln stood to lose everything for the sake of a murderer. And for our star tonight, the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you the greatest living interpreter of Lincoln, Raymond Massey.
Thank you, Dick. You know, if Hallmark greeting cards were to carry one Lincoln's Day message to our friends, they could do no better than tell something that happened to me once. You've already told the story on your Reader's Digest radio edition. But it actually happened to me.
What was it, Ray?
Well, I was on tour in Abe Lincoln, Illinois. After one performance, a very old man came around to my dressing room. Massey said, "I like the way you play, Mr. Lincoln, but I heard you say the Gettysburg Address over the radio a few weeks ago, and you make the same mistake as everyone else. I heard Mr. Lincoln give that speech at Gettysburg. I was only a few feet away, so I know what I'm talking about. He said, of the people, by the people, and for the people. But Mr. Lincoln said, of the people, and for the people. It makes a difference."
It always made a difference to Abraham Lincoln when the people were concerned, Ray. But that's our story. The makers of Hallmark greeting cards present tonight on the Reader's Digest radio edition, Raymond Massey in The Council of Signs.
Come to my opponent. Who is he? Just where did he come from? Is he fit to represent you good people in the halls of Congress? Those are some of the questions we should ask about my opponent. Is he the sort of man we want to send to the House of Representatives in Washington to deal with the momentous affairs of this great nation? Do you want such a man? Now I ask you, do you want an ugly, awkward bumpkin representing you? You've seen my opponent and you've heard him speak. And I'm quite sure that you have the good sense to realize that the last man in this world to send to Congress is this gangling, clumsy dolt, this oaf, this backwoodsman, this Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln!
Tom, sit down.
Abe, this looks bad.
That's so?
Don't be so calm about it.
All right, I'll get excited to please an old friend if you'll calm down to please me.
Don't try to be funny, Abe. We're going to lose the election if you don't stir yourself.
All right, now look, Tom, I'm trying to catch up on my mail. Now, I'll just sit here and look over these letters, and you sit there and tell me the bad news. That way, we'll both enjoy ourselves.
I just came from Meeting Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Cartwright made a speech.
Nothing unscheduled about that.
He poked fun at you, Abe.
Picked a good subject, didn't he?
He said you were awkward and silly. He made fun of your looks.
Can't imagine why.
And they laughed. They laughed at you, Abe.
I see. The weapon of ridicule, eh?
Yes. And it worked. Abe, after that speech, Cartwright, I wouldn't want to guarantee that anyone in that hall would ever vote for you.
I wouldn't want to guarantee that they would.
You don't know how effective he was, Abe. He painted the most ludicrous picture of you until they had him rocking with laughter. And then he asked how such a man as Abe Lincoln could ever get along with the great statesman in Washington.
I've been wondering some about that myself.
Well, what are you going to do?
Why, I'd say the whole contest hinges on my speech Friday. Tom, it's my last chance.
Yes.
I'll talk to them. You heard me talk. You know the people seem to like me.
I know.
Well, I'll just stand up before them and be honest. I'll admit that Cartwright is correct.
Abe, are you fooling?
No. I'll tell them I plead guilty to the charge of being awkward. I'll confess I never know what to do with my hands. I'll do public penance for having been born in the backwoods. And I'll tell him Cartwright was very kind to call me ugly when the fact is I'm repulsive.
Hey, that's good. You'll make everything Cartwright said look ridiculous.
I think then I'll ask all the handsome ones and all the polished ones and all the ones who feel at home with great statesmen to vote for Cartwright to represent them. But I'll allow as how I might make a pretty good representative for the homely and the awkward and the timid.
That's wonderful. I should have known better. I should have known that you could speak to the people in their own language. Abe, we're going to win this election.
Maybe. Now, let me get back to this mess.
As soon as you make that speech, you're as good as elected.
Maybe, maybe. Oh.
What's the matter, Abe?
This is bad.
Something in that letter, Abe? Bad news?
Rather bad news, yes, Tom.
Can I help?
Not unless you can tell me how a man can be in two places at once.
What do you mean?
I mean I can't make the speech Friday.
What?
I can't be here.
Why not?
Because I gotta be elsewhere.
But Abe...
No, no, that's all I can tell you, Tom.
But Abe, we'll lose the election.
Tom, I got two things to say to that. First, no man should set himself up as knowing what the people will do in any election. The people will elect the man they want, whether I make a speech or not.
I tell you, we'll lose the election if you don't make it.
Which brings me to the second point. There are some things more important than election. I won't make the speech because I won't be in this town on Friday. I'll be 20 miles away. And I'll be very, very busy, Tom.
Come to order. Mr. District Attorney, what case are you to bring before the court?
The case of John Wilson, indicted for the murder of William Shaughnessy on October 10th, 1845.
Is the defendant present?
You mean me, Judge?
You're John Wilson?
Yes, sir.
Have you a lawyer?
No. I don't know anybody. I ain't got money to pay.
Do you wish the court to assign you counsel?
I don't know.
Your Honor.
Who is it who addresses the court? The court.
Your Honor, I am a lawyer. I should be glad to act as counsel for the defense.
What's your name?
Abraham Lincoln.
Well, I know your name, counsel. I should be glad to assign you to defend the prisoner. I hope you won't need much time to confer with him.
I won't need any time, Your Honor. I have been told the facts of this case.
Very well. Mr. District Attorney, will you state your case?
And please, Your Honor. Gentlemen of the jury, this case is a very simple one in which there is no doubt
that
a murder was committed.
Hello.
You don't remember me, do you? How old are you?
15.
15. I'm sorry for you, my boy.
You think they'll tell me?
I don't know. Let's listen to the case against
William Shaughnessy, thus killing him. After the state's witness testifies as to these facts, and they are facts, it will be my solemn duty to ask you, gentlemen of the jury,
for the life of John Wilson. And it will be your duty to find him guilty, that he may be sentenced to hang. Now, as my first witness, may I call Amos Berry.
Amos Berry, take the stand.
Yes, Your Honor.
Amos Berry, do you swear to tell truth, whole truth, nothing but truth, help God?
I do.
Be kidding.
Proceed with the questioning of the witness. Mr. Berry, you own a farm 3 miles out of town?
I do.
On October 10th last, what employees did you have on that farm?
John Wilson.
The prisoner?
Yes.
Any other employees?
One other, William Sharp.
The man John Wilson murdered?
Yes.
Doesn't the defense attorney intend to object to that last question?
No objection, Your Honor.
As you please. Proceed. Now, Mr. Berry, what were the relations of the prisoner to William Shaughnessy?
He hated Shaughnessy.
Why?
I don't know. Shaughnessy was a great joker. maybe that's why.
Did you like Shaughnessy?
Very much. He's a great one for making everyone laugh.
So, if somebody did not like him, you'd think that person was unnatural.
Yes.
Just a moment. I'm willing to entertain an objection to that question and to the whole line of questioning.
Your Honor, I'm willing for the district attorney to question this man any way he sees fit.
Well, all right. Go on, Mr. District Attorney. Mr. Berry, tell us about the events of October 10th.
Well, sir, I suppose you mean about the murder.
I mean about the murder.
Well, sir, Shaughnessy and me were standing at the gate to the hayfield when the boy come along.
By the boy, you mean John Wilson?
That's right. He was driving a wagon load of hay to the next farm. He yelled down from the wagon to ask me to open the gate. Shaughnessy said, let him get down off the wagon and open himself. Come on down, Johnny, he yelled. Don't be so lazy. Open the gate yourself.
And that's when John Wilson murdered Shaughnessy? Well, counsel,
I haven't said anything, Your Honor. I have no objection. Let him go on.
Very well. When Shaughnessy called to John Wilson to get off the wagon and open the gate himself, that's when the murder took place?
Not right that second. John got down all right. He was piping mad. I guess he didn't know that Shaughnessy was just fooling.
It was just a harmless joke.
Well, yes. And as the boy walked toward the gate, Shaughnessy picked up a pitchfork and said, get a move on there, Johnny, and touched it to his backside. Johnny whirled, grabbed the pitchfork out of Shaughnessy's hand and ran it right through his skull.
Killing him.
Yes, sir.
There it is. The prisoner at the bar is so depraved that already at the age of 15, he has taken a man's life. A simple case of murder for which the defendant must pay the penalty.
Your witness, Mr. Lincoln.
I have no questions to ask the witness.
Mr. Judge, we're all sore back here in the audience. The boy done it and the boy's got to hang. But why don't his lawyer do something for him?
Get another lawyer!
Order! Order in the court. In order to give various tempers a chance to cool down, this court hereby takes a recess for lunch.
Mr. Lincoln, are they going to hang him, Mr. Lincoln?
Son, I don't know. You did kill Shaughnessy, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
All right, son. I understand. I understand why, and I'll try to help you.
But that man said...
I wasn't doing anything to help you. Well, son, please believe me. I have my method, just as the district attorney has his. This afternoon, it'll be my turn. And I pray to God I won't fail.
Mr. Lincoln, will you open the case for the defense?
You all right, sonny?
I don't know, Mr. Lincoln.
Don't be scared, son. I'm going to pull you out of this hole, trying to be plucky for your mother's sake.
Mr. Lincoln...
Yes, Your Honor. May it please Your Honor and gentlemen of the jury, I'm going to try this case in a manner not customary in the courts. I shall not call witnesses. All I'm going to do is to tell you a story and then leave the case in your hands. Now, you gentlemen of the jury, you Jim Beck, you Jack Armstrong, you two can remember. Yes, and you as well, Lou Green. You can remember 15 years back when a long, lanky fella in God's forsaken clothes came into this country from Indiana. He was dressed in homespun jeans with the breeches stuffed into rawhide boots. I'm sure you remember that young man. His name was Abraham Lincoln. I'd left home to shift for myself, and in those pinching times, I could not always get work. Late one afternoon, when I'd walked miles looking for a chance, I came upon a cabin. It was a poor cabin, even as settlers' cabins go. There was cloth over the windows instead of glass. It was the home of poor people. I went up to the door and knocked.
Hello?
Hello. I knocked because I...
Because you're tired.
I didn't know you could tell so easily.
I can tell. Come on in.
Thank you.
This is my wife.
Welcome. You come far?
I've been tramping most of the day.
Well, then you'll be tired and hungry.
Sit down here.
I'll get some food for you.
People are very kind.
Poor people have to be kind. They need kindness so often themselves. I'll only be...
Why don't you take off your shoes?
Oh, there's no need.
Well, your feet must be tired.
Well, my feet are tired, but I must say you're making my spirit feel mighty lively.
Here's a nice hot soup. This will keep you occupied while I fry up some potatoes and meat. Oh,
thank you, ma'am. I can't say when I've been made to feel so much like a king.
We're very glad to help you. Where are you staying tonight?
I counted on walking into the next town.
Oh, nonsense. You're too tired. When you finish eating, we'll make up a bunk for you near the fireplace.
Oh, no, no. There is no need of that.
Of course.
Oh, no, no. Well, I'm not tired.
We'll make up a bunk for you, stranger.
Slept in that little cabin all night. Fact is, I was tired. So tired that I overslept. I might be sleeping yet if a sound hadn't wakened me. A very sweet sound.
Oh, morning.
Well, good morning. What time is it?
It's almost 10 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, wow.
I didn't know you had a child.
He was asleep last night. Wow, wow, baby. I'll make you breakfast as soon as I can sing him to sleep.
Ma'am, I'll make a bargain with you.
What is it?
I don't deserve breakfast, but if you want to make it, you hand that little baby over to me, and I'll sing him to sleep.
I'm getting the best of that bargain. Here.
Well, the baby ain't anyway.
I'll have breakfast ready in a jiffy.
Oh, now, look, son. The trick is not to look at my face. Then you won't have to cry so hard. Now, wait. Sweet and low, sweet and low, wind of the western sea. That's it, son. You like it here, don't you? I like it here myself. Well, that's one of the heartiest breakfasts I've had in weeks.
I'm glad you liked it.
You just go on about your work and let me clean up these dishes.
Why don't we both do them?
All right. Then I'll be on my way.
Where are you going?
Oh, I'm not quite sure.
You're looking for work, aren't you?
Yes.
I thought so.
What is it, ma'am?
Well, we haven't got much money, but my husband has got work for someone that might need it. He's clearing the forest around here, and work goes slow. He's out there now, all alone, and he needs something.
Well, then I want to help by all means.
He couldn't pay much, but you could stay here with us, and you'd be fed and have a place to sleep.
You don't know what that means to me.
I have an idea.
I've been hungry in the days and cold by nights for more than 2 weeks now. Last night, I knocked on your door. You and your husband took me in and fed me and made me feel comfortable. More than that, made me feel human again.
We know what it is to be hungry.
And now you give me work and shelter.
I hope you understand we can't pay enough.
That's where you're wrong. You're paying very much. Very much indeed. I only hope I can repay you someday.
Perhaps you can. Poor people always need help from one another.
Gentlemen of the jury, for 5 weeks I lived in that cabin. I chopped wood with the father, did housework with the mother, and romped with the laughing baby many a time. No part of my life has ever been more lighthearted or happy. Now, by good fortune, by the blessing of God, I've made for myself a certain place in the community. As much as might be, I have kept in touch with those old friends. But in the stress of a busy life, I have not of late years heard from them. Till last Monday morning, a letter came to me from the mother who welcomed a tired youth to her cabin so many years ago. Her husband had died, and in trouble now, she turned to me. That mother sits there.
Order! Order!
The baby she sang to, the baby that I myself sang to sleep while she prepared my breakfast, that baby is the prisoner at the bar.
Order! Order in the court! Go on, Mr. Lincoln.
Many times I have prayed to God to give me a chance to show my gratitude to those poor people. When the letter came last Monday, I knew that God had answered me. But the answer to a prayer comes sometimes with a demand for sacrifice. It was so this time. Today I was to have made a speech which bore equal likely success or failure in the contest. I lay my ambition gladly on the altar of this boy's safety. Gentlemen of the jury, you know that at this boy's age, his hand should have held school books or a fishing rod, not a pitchfork. You can take that into consideration. You can take into consideration the fact that Shaughnessy, the man he killed, yes, we admit that John Wilson killed, was a practical joke, that he goaded this child until in desperation John Wilson used the pitchfork that was at hand. You know these things as well as I do. All I ask is that you deal with the little fellow as you would of other men in such a case, deal with little fellows of your own at home. Gentlemen of the jury, I rest my case.
Finds the defendant not guilty.
Come in.
Mr. Lincoln?
Mrs. Wilson and John. Come in, come in. Here, sit down.
Mr. Lincoln, my mother and I came to thank you.
I was too upset after the trial.
So was I.
I understood.
You... Well, we haven't got a great deal of money to pay you.
You said that to me once before, Mrs. Wilson.
Yes, I remember.
Let's say no more about payment or repayment, will we?
Tell him, Mother.
Yes, John, just a minute.
Tell me what?
Well, John and I know that you gave up your chance to make that speech, to help us. And someone told us that would likely lose the election for you.
There are some things more important than elections, Mrs. Wilson.
Well, that's not for me to judge, Mr. Lincoln, but we thought, John and I, that if people knew why you weren't here to make that speech, it might help you to win. So we've been going from house to house here in town, telling them.
You've been going from house to house?
I hope we didn't do wrong, Mr. Lincoln.
Wrong?
I mean, we only did what we thought might help. If we said anything...
You didn't do wrong, Mrs. Wilson. I just couldn't find the words to tell you how I feel. I guess there are only two words to say, anyhow. Just thank you. Whether it makes any difference in the election or not, thank you, Mrs. Wilson. And God bless you.
Mr.
typical backwoods election. A tall, shambling man running for Congress, and a shabby woman and a son patiently going from house to house speaking a few words of explanation. But from these simple roots sprang something far bigger than the woman and a son ever dreamed. For Abraham Lincoln was elected to Congress, the first step on the road that was to lead him to the presidency of the United States and to enduring greatness. Thank you, Raymond Massey, for a compelling interpretation of an exciting story.
Well, of course, Dick, no prosecutor would let such a defense stand today. Only Mr. Lincoln could have done it even in 1845. Only a man whose sense of justice was greater than his ambition.
The Radio Reader's Digest on Tuned to Yesterday from February 13th, 1947 on CBS. Raymond Massey portrayed Abraham Lincoln in that broadcast, and he was known as America's Lincoln at that time. He had starred in the stage production of Abe Lincoln in Illinois, which was turned into a major motion picture in 1940, for which he was nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor in a Leading Role. He also appeared as Lincoln four times on television, in addition to the 1962 film How the West Was Won. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. And now a story from John Adams, who is portrayed by Basil Rathbone in the episode John Yankee on the Cavalcade of America. An NBC broadcast first heard on August 29th, 1950.
Of Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, Basil Rathbone. Good evening, everyone. This is Bill Hamilton bringing you greetings from the men and women of the DuPont Company as the Cavalcade of America starts its 16th season. In our story tonight, Basil Rathbone appears as John Adams, attorney for the defense, in one of the most famous murder trials in our history.
Order, please. The clerk will continue. It is here charged that the aforesaid defendants, eight in number, and soldiers of the crown, not having the fear of God before their eyes, but being moved and seduced by the instigation of the devil and their own wicked hearts, did on the fifth day of March with force and arms feloniously, willfully, and of their malice aforethought, do unto death the aforesaid five citizens of Boston town.
The prisoners have heard the indictment. How do they plead?
Not guilty. Not guilty.
God sends you good deliverance. Let the trial proceed.
The story of this famous American murder trial is told by the attorney for the defense. For it is his story, too. His name? John Adams. That same John Adams who was one day to become the second president of the United States.
They were innocent under the law, those eight British soldiers, and I knew it. Yet to plead their cause in the year 1770 was the most difficult task I ever undertook. I think the story might well begin on an early summer evening 2 years before the trial. Abigail and I had a guest for dinner at our house in Brattle Street, Boston, my closest friend, Jonathan Sewell.
An excellent wine, John. Excellent. Where did he get it, Abby? Some of John Hancock's contraband treasure, the wine of liberty?
Now, Mr. Sewell, no politics, please.
Oh, nonsense, my dear Abby. I may be a king's man, I am a Tory, and I glory in it. But my political convictions do not extend to smuggled Madeira. In a vintage so fine, I'll drink to either party.
I wish I could view our present trouble so lightly, Jonathan.
Oh, John. John, my friend. When will you ever learn to unbend a little? Can't you teach him, Abigail?
I'd not care to try, Mrs. Sewell. I'd not want to try, sir.
Perhaps I can make the attempt. We'll see. have news for you, John.
Yes, I thought you might by the gleam in your eye. Abby, would you mind?
I was about to see to the children, John. Good night, Mr. Sewell.
Good night, dear lady. You'll kiss little Abby good night for me and John Quincy, too.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, John?
Well, Jonathan?
I won't beat about the bush, my old friend. I've been sent by Governor Barnard to offer you the post of Advocate General in the King's Admiralty Court of Massachusetts.
What?
Now, don't bridle and draw back like an offended maiden. It means your fortune is made, man.
It means I should sit in judgment on my friends who have avoided the King's tax and grow rich upon their substance.
It means new friends, John. Friends who have the ear of the King himself. Who are your precious friends now, these so-called sons of liberty? Her penniless adventurers.
John Hancock, James Otis, Dr. Warren, Ben Eddies of the Gazette, my cousin Samuel, some of the most substantial men in our colony.
No, Sam Adams is a dockside demagogue, a tattered ne'er-do-well, a troublemaker.
Jonathan, you too are my friend. I have none closer or more dear, so you must have known my answer would be no. I cannot change my political principles.
But His Excellency mentioned that point to me most especially. He desired me to say that your political sentiments will be no objection, no objection whatever. He offers you the post merely because you are the best qualified.
It was a bribe and I knew it. An attempt to break the ranks of the royal governor's opponents. But I couldn't accuse my old friend of trying to bribe me or of supposing I could be bribed. We talked late and long. He made me promise to consult my wife. And when he had gone, I found Abby waiting at our bedroom window. I told her and she said...
Yes, John, it is a bribe. Of course it is.
A high bribe, a good price, easy to take.
Yes, then more would follow. You could be Chief Justice, Sir John Adams. The court party fears my husband.
Do you want me to take the post, my dear?
John, are you testing me? You know that isn't necessary. Just as I know you'll always refuse such offers. Oh, my friend, my partner, they say you're an ambitious man. Is it not something of a satisfaction to be so feared by the powerful?
It is. It is indeed. And beloved by such a wise and lovely lady as well. There's a gift no king could offer.
My, Jonathan was wrong. You can unbend on the proper occasion. Listen. The watchman. Must be very late.
All is well, but a storm is brewing in Boston town, a blow to put the stars out. Somehow, Abby, somehow I'm afraid I rejoice in the coming storm, and I hate it, too.
'Twill clear the air. There'll be brighter stars ahead, I think.
All men knew that trouble was near in Massachusetts. Before long, there were 4,000 British soldiers quartered upon us in Boston. One to each four inhabitants. The king's taxes threatened the livelihood of every man. A powder keg. Yes, a powder keg with a long fuse. Among the Sons of Liberty, there were those who counseled moderation. I was one of them. And there were the firebrands. My cousin Sam was their leader. I remember he said...
John, we're proud of you. To stand fast and refuse a certain fortune as
you... How did you know? Jonathan Sewell told no one but me.
Sons of Liberty have ways of knowing... Your loyalty will be rewarded, cousin, in the future.
If I thought of rewards, I'd have taken the crown post. And if you take my advice, Sam, you'll move more slowly. If violence must come, let it not be said that we began the open quarrel. I say but this. Break no law. The law is my guide.
But whose law? The king's law?
No. The ancient common law of England by which we live. If we break it, we're lost. The law is our most precious weapon, Sam.
I've heard of weapons that speak louder. You ask me to hold back the inevitable thunder, to stem the very tide of great events. The Sons of Liberty are prepared to seize the tide at the flood and move on to freedom and glory. Now we wait upon events, to be sure. But perhaps we can shape events a little, or more than a little. The flood tide, cousin, is almost here. The time to tread softly has passed.
I never liked the tolling bells of Boston, preferring the quiet of our stony acres at Braintree. But Abby loved the voice of the bells. Christchurch bells, she said, made a lordly sound. The New North chime was out of tune. King's Chapel rang out,
deep and slow, as if it had to tell a story. Cheer, Abby. I like a woman's fancy. But soon the lordly bells were to make a new sound, a savage sound. Alarum bells ringing in the night as for fire. For the flood tide came as Cousin Sam said it would. In a waterfront rope walk at lunch hour, English soldiers and Boston workmen exchanged obscenities and unforgivable blows were struck. The next morning, a poster appeared, tacked up in a dockside tavern. It read,
"This is to inform the rebellious people in Boston that the soldiers in the 14th and 29th regiments are determined to join together and defend themselves against all who shall oppose them. Sign, the soldiers of the 14th and 29th regiments." Well, 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 we'll see about that.
Yes, we'll see about that.
Bloody lobster backs.
Who posted that notice? Was it truly the soldiers? Or might it have been that mysterious gentleman in the red cloak and white wig who was everywhere on that fatal day? No one will ever know. But as night falls, strolling crowds of Liberty boys begin to fill the streets. Barber's apprentice insults a sentinel. The sentinel gives chase. Whacks the boy with the butt of his musket. Snowballs and ice begin to fill the air. An oyster shell, sharp, dangerous as razor blades. As if on a signal, the alarum bells break out. Red cloak and white wig is everywhere, urging on the rioters. Captain Preston, commanding the guard, brings seven men to rescue the sentinel. Crowd presses in. One of the soldiers is hit by an oyster shell, slips on the ice and falls. His gun goes off in the air. There is no order to fire, but this is the high tide. Here is the powder, and here is the flint. This is the inevitable hour, and the spark is struck. Three were dead, two mortally wounded. Quickly the red-clad regiments poured into the streets, bayonets glistening in the moonlight. The alarum bells ceased as suddenly as they had begun. By 3 a.m, Boston was quiet again. Next day, I found Cousin Sam and Ben Eddies, editor of the Gazette, waiting for me at my office.
John, we need your advice, as ever it seems.
It may be too late now, Ben. I see the streets are filling up with armed men. Sam, surely you'll not carry this thing any further?
No, John, enough is enough. But the farm lads are flocking in.
Get them home. That's my advice. Get them quickly home. Sam, who was the man in the red cloak and white wig?
Cousin, I'll thank you not to peer down your great nose at me in that fashion. This is my only cloak, and it's black, rusty, and threadbare enough, as you see.
Ben, see who that is. Look through the window.
Mr. Forrester, the man they call the Irish Infant, a friend of Captain Preston.
Let him in, Ben.
Mr. Adams, thanks be to God and his angels, I found you in. Oh, man, 'tis a terrible thing, a terrible thing.
What is your business, Mr. Forrester?
I come from Captain Preston, sir. He's in great danger. He and his men will be tried at once for murder itself. All the great Tory lawyers have refused his case in fear of their precious necks. Captain Preston wants you to defend him, sir. As God is my witness, John Adams, those men are innocent. They but saved their own skins in the night, confronted and threatened by the yelling mob.
Yes. Yes. They were at their posts, on duty. They are innocent. They acted in self-defense.
John, you can't do this. You'll ruin your career. By refusing the governor's bribe, you lost all royal favor. By doing this thing, you'll be cursed forever by men on our side, the side for liberty, your own party. You risk your very life defending these massacring British soldiers. You can't do it, John.
I can and I will. Those men are innocent and you know it. They cannot be denied a defender. Mr. Eddies?
Yes, John?
In the Gazette today, you will kindly announce that John Adams will defend the King's soldiers now lying in jail under capital charges. The rule of justice, you may say, not mob rule, must prevail in Boston town. Come along, Forrester. We'll talk to the prisoners.
You are listening to the DuPont Cavalcade of America, starring Basil Rathbone and sponsored by the DuPont Company, makers of better things for better living through chemistry. We continue the DuPont Cavalcade of America with Basil Rathbone as John Adams. In colonial Boston, a great murder trial is taking place. The lives of 8 British soldiers are at stake. John Adams, risking the ruin of his career, perhaps his life, is their counselor, determined that justice shall be done.
Our first move was to get a postponement of trial. Let the passions of my fellow townsmen cool a bit. Young Josiah Quincy was my associate in the case, and together we found 50 Bostonians calm enough to remember what actually happened that night. When the trial began, we had 96 witnesses against us. Honest men, guided not by reason, but by emotion, telling what they thought had happened. One by one, they took the stand, day in, day out.
There came in 7 soldiers from the main guard without any coats on, driving along, swearing and cursing like wild creatures, crying, "Slay the Yankee! Slay them all!"
I say Private Kilroy's bayonet was thick with dried blood, up to 3 inches from the point. 3 inches of blood. I saw it with my own eyes. 3 bloody inches.
Then our turn came. Hour by hour, the truth piled up on the word of our witnesses. Finally, Dr. Jeffries took the stand. He was the physician who had attended young Patrick Carr, one of the slain citizens, in his dying hours. My colleague for the defense, Josiah Quincy, was examining.
Now, Dr. Jeffries, you visited young Carr, the innocent bystander, after he was injured.
I did, Mr. Quincy, yes.
What did you say to him?
After dressing his wounds, I advised him never again to go into quarrels and riots.
And what did he say?
He agreed I had a good idea there. Told me also that he was a native of Ireland. He had frequently seen mobs and soldiers called upon to quell them.
I see. Now,
he said more.
Oh, go on, Doctor.
He said that never in all his life had he seen soldiers bear so much abuse before they were forced to fire upon a mob in self-defense.
My lord, I object. Witness is expressing impulse.
Order. Order, please. We sustain the crowd. Proceed, Mr. Quincy.
How long did Patrick Carr live after he received his wound?
10 days, almost to the minute.
And when had you a last conversation with him?
About 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the day he died.
And what did this dying boy say to you?
He said, "I forgive the man who shot me, whoever he is. As God will judge me soon, that soldier fired only to save himself from certain death."
And then, with a prayer in my heart that our months of toil might have just reward, I heard his lordship declare,
"Mr. John Adams will sum up the cause of the defendant."
May it please your lordships, and you gentlemen of the jury, I am for the prisoners of the bar, and shall apologize for it only in the words of a great Italian jurist, the Marquis of Beccaria. He said, "If I can be but the instrument of preserving one life, his blessing upon my head shall be a sufficient consolation to me for the contempt of all mankind." We talk much of liberty and property, but if we cut up the law of self-defense, we cut away the foundation of both. Place yourselves in the situation of Kilroy or the sentry, with the people shouting, "Kill them! Kill them!" on heaving snowballs, oyster shells, clubs,
heavy birch sticks. Consider yourselves in the situation and then decide if a reasonable man would not consider they were going to kill him. The law considers a man as capable of bearing anything and everything but blows. I may reproach a man as much as I please. I may call him a thief, a robber, lobster bag. And if he kills me, it will be murder. But if from giving him such kind of language I proceed to molest his person, that is an assault. That is a blow. The law will not oblige a man to stand still and bear it. There is the distinction. Hands off! Touch me not. As soon as you touch me then, if I run you through the heart, it is but manslaughter. The law reads, he who on an assault retreats to the wall beyond which he can go no further before he kills the other is judged to act upon another point. As I said to you yesterday, I proceed to lest his person...
How long has he been talking now?
Since 11 o'clock yesterday morning.
Reads,
4 o'clock almost now. Nearly 12 hours, yesterday and today.
He can't talk much longer now.
To use the words of Algernon Sidney, our law no passion can disturb. 'Tis void of desire and fear, lust and anger. 'Tis written reason, retaining some measure of the divine perfection. Our law commands that which is good and punishes evil in all, whether rich or poor, high or low. 'Tis death inexorable, inflexible. So Sidney wrote. The law here, on the one hand, is inexorable to the cries and lamentations of these prisoners. On the other hand, it is deaf. Deaf as an adder to the clamors of the populace of Boston. Gentlemen of the jury, to your candor and justice, I submit the prisoners and their cause.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
And what is your verdict?
The soldiers, William Wems, James Hartigan, William McCauley, Hugh White, William Warren, and John Carroll are not guilty. Soldiers Matthew Kilroy and Hugh Montgomery are not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter.
Your Lordship, on behalf of the two defendants, Kilroy and Montgomery, proved guilty of manslaughter, I ask the benefit of clergy.
An archaic but perfectly legal plea, Mr. Adams. It is granted. They will be set free after they've been branded in the thumb. It is our usage that this be done at once. The bailiff will prepare the fire and the iron, and the court will please remain in order.
Well, Abby, it's over. Over and won, over and done.
I'm proud of you, John.
I did what I had to do, but what now? My day in the courts of this colony is over. Would you like to be a poor farmer's wife, Abby?
I'd be quite content, but I don't believe that'll be necessary. You've won a greater victory than you suppose, my dear.
I saved the lives of 8 innocent men. That's enough. I made 12 good men and true see the right according to law and declare it. That's quite enough.
But you did more. You won the minds and the hearts and the goodwill of the people of Massachusetts. Perhaps the people are wiser than you think, John. They will not make you suffer for having upheld their laws so well.
And by God's grace and her own wisdom, Abby was right. A few years later, I wrote in my diary, there is a new and grand scene open before me, a Congress. I had been elected to that Congress by the people of Massachusetts, and the bells of Boston rang out in celebration as we set out for Philadelphia, with Cousin Samuel and me reunited again in the great cause of liberty and on the cushions of a fine coach. Cousin, I said, that's a most impressive red cloak you're wearing.
You like it, Cousin? It was given me just last week by the Sons of Liberty.
It is most becoming. You're quite sure it is a new one, cousin?
Oh, yes, cousin. Quite sure. You see, I always wanted a red cloak. Drive more slowly, boy. The people wish to see us.
And have you reflected, cousin, we may be driving towards a gallows tree?
I have thought much of the king's rope, cousin, but not too much. And you, John, you're still with us?
To the end. Whatever that may be, I have crossed over my river. I have passed my Rubicon. I will never change. Sink or swim, survive or perish, I am with my country.
The DuPont Company joins in applauding Basil Rathbone and the Cavalcade players for their performances tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, the star of tonight's DuPont Cavalcade of America, Basil Rathbone.
Thank you. I just want to say first off that I enjoyed being here tonight, this opening night of the new season. There are many good stories ahead for Cavalcade listeners, and good stars, too. On next Tuesday night, for instance, you're going to hear an exciting story about four men who ventured into the very heart of the Venezuelan jungle and come out with one of the greatest discoveries of our day. Dane Clark is going to head up with that expedition. So be sure to hear it. Good night now.
Tonight's original DuPont drama was written by George H. Faulkner and was taken from an incident in the historical biography John Adams and the American Revolution by Catherine Drinker Bowen, published by Little Brown and Company. Tonight's star, Basil Rathbone, will soon appear in the Broadway production, The Gioconda's Smile. The music for the DuPont Cavalcade of America was composed by Arden Cornwell and conducted by Donald Voorhees. The program is directed by John Zoller.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned 2 yesterday from August 29th, 1950 on NBC. That wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark the Vanier. It's been a pleasure.